Hello and welcome to the Learning College Vanguard Audiobooks. Today we're going to do Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control by E. Michael Jones, back from the year 2000. We're going to do one chapter today, Part 3, Chapter 9, South Bend, Indiana, 1962. South Bend being the home of Notre Dame, most notably, and that's also where E. Michael Jones is based. This will be a little bit shorter chapter. I've decided we're going to do cut down the length of these some from here on in. So we probably got about 15 chapters left. Let's see. I think that's right. We're on 9, there's 21, so yeah, about 12 maybe. And there's no afterword either, so. This will go from page 402 to 417, so only about 15 pages. Keep it under an hour, probably. Part 3, Chapter 9, South Bend, Indiana, 1962. During the 50s, especially before Roth v. United States lamed obscenity prosecution, a curious double bind arose in relations between the American and Italian film industries and their respective cultures. Hollywood was bound by the production code, the Hays Code, largely a Catholic enterprise which came into being during the early 30s, and they boycotted until the Jews broke down and cried big, greasy tears as big as horse turds, as the quote went. And agreed to not put immorality in their films. And that lasted for the 30s, 40s, 50s, and into the 60s. So he's saying there's a dual code in Italy and the U.S. in Hollywood. They could not portray nudity or profanity. In order to break the code, producers like Joseph E. Levine would bring over Italian films by directors like Federico Fellini, made largely in Rome, the headquarters of the Catholic Church. One of Fellini's short films was part of a trilogy which provoked the Burstyn court case in New York in the early 50s, where the Catholics went to the barricades to defend the culture against what they saw as a deluge of degenerate films coming from Catholic Italy. Certain Italians, however, were equally upset by the effect that American films were having on Italy. One of the people most upset was Pope Pius XII, who had much to say on the role of television and film. But as Pius XII slowly slipped into his dotage during the 50s, others took up his cause. Alfredo Cardinal Ottaviani was so concerned about the effect of film that he created his own chain of movie theaters to ensure that only films that had no detrimental effect on morals would be shown. And Ottaviani, we've heard in other places, was the main conservative at the Vatican II. So he has his own chain of movie theaters to show morally good stuff. Writing in 1950, at a time when Pius XII and Cardinal Ottaviani were preoccupied with a communist menace, W.W. Charters talked about the effect that film had on children in dark theaters. Quote, "Watching in the dark of the theater, the young child sits in the presence of reality when he observes the actors perform and the plot of the drama unfold. He sees the actions of people living in a real world, not of actors playing a make-believe role. His emotions are aroused in ways that have been described. He forgets his surroundings. He loses ordinary control of his feelings, his actions, and his thoughts. He identifies himself with the plot and loses himself in the picture. His emotional condition may get such a strong grip that even his efforts to rid himself of it by reasoning with himself may prove of little avail. He is possessed by the drama." Remember, back in mid-century that they're talking about, film was probably the major medium, more so than even TV at that point. The quote comes not from an indignant Catholic prelate concerned about the manipulation of passion, but from a collection of essays edited by Bernard Berelson, one of the prime psychological warriors of the 50s, and eventually the head of John D. Rockefeller's Population Council. In many ways, Cardinal Ottaviani couldn't have framed the case against Hollywood better himself, and over the course of the 50s, as the threat of communism waned, the threat from Hollywood grew in an inverse proportion. Ottaviani became so concerned at the effect that Hollywood culture was having on Catholic life in Italy that he and Cardinal Tardini went to Pius XII's successor, Giuseppe Roncalli, during the very conclave which named him Pope John XXIII, and told him that he must convene an ecumenical council to deal with the sclerotic state of church administration and the threat to the church from the outside, a threat just over the horizon, but no less palpable for that. Ottaviani was responsible for the writing of all the preliminary documents of Vatican II, most of which were scrapped by the council, which was looking for new ways of dealing with the problems facing the church. The issue of methodology, however, should not distract us from the intention that drove the convoking of the council. Ottaviani and Tardini were convinced that the church was not prepared to face the onslaught against morals and family life that was being orchestrated through the media by the United States, their ostensible partner in the anti-communist crusade. In his document on the moral order, dated January 15, 1962, Ottaviani criticizes the attempt, quote, "to substitute the useful, the agreeable, the good of the race, the interest of a class, or the power of a state as the criterion of morality. Thus, philosophical systems, literary fashions, and political doctrines have been created and propagated. These try to substitute for the Christian moral order the so-called morality of situation or individualistic morality, often condemned by Pius XII and finally condemned by a decree of the Holy Office in February of 1956. These also try to substitute the morality of independence, i.e., divorced from Christian morality, for the idea of God, sanction, and obligation. The reference to those who elevate the interests of class seems clear enough. However, as one reads further, it becomes clear that Ottaviani's preliminary document on the moral order is best seen as an attack on both sides of the Cold War, and before long the attacks on the Church's supposed ally in the anti-communist crusade take precedence over the attacks on their putative common enemy. Ottaviani attacks those who create, quote, so-called conflicts between art and morality, between freedom of expression and conscience, an oblique reference to the increasingly beleaguered situation of the League of Decency and its efforts to uphold moral standards in cinema in the face of Hollywood's determined efforts to bring nudity to the big screen. Ottaviani attacks, finally, all, quote, errors which degrade human dignity under the false pretext of freeing man from all bonds that would restrict his nature in some way. The moral order has the task not only of leading man to his true end, but of defending him against all doctrines and practices that would enslave him to the minds, modes, and passions that are contrary to the dignity of his intellect. Enslaving the mind to passions which are contrary to the intellect was precisely the project that was being pursued by the psychological warriors throughout the 50s. The whole point of advertising was to have its messages elude the mind's rational control, to manipulate the customer into buying something that he didn't need, or into buying something for reasons other than utility. Throughout the 50s, the OSS alumni were putting their discoveries at the lucrative service of American corporations who were using them to coerce consumers into making choices that were not in their own interest. Since World War II, Simpson writes, quote, "the U.S. government's national security campaigns have usually overlapped with the commercial ambitions of major advertisers and media companies, and with the aspiration of an enterprising stratum of university administrators and professors. Military, intelligence, and propaganda agencies such as the Department of Defense and the CIA help bankroll substantially all of the post-World War II generation's research into techniques of persuasion, opinion measurement, interrogation, political and military mobilization, propagation of ideology, and allied questions. The persuasion studies, in particular, provided much of the scientific underpinning for modern advertising and motivational techniques." As Ottaviani continues, the object of his ire becomes more apparent. After telling us that the moral order defends the immutable principles of Christian modesty and chastity, he goes on to say, quote, "we know the energy spent at the present time by the world of fashion, movies, and the press in order to shake the foundations of Christian morality in this regard, as if the Sixth Commandment should be considered outmoded and free rein should be given to all passions, even those against nature. The council will have something to say concerning this subject. It will clarify and eventually condemn all the attempts to revive paganism and all the trends that, in the abuse of psychoanalysis, tend to justify even those things which are directly contrary to the moral order." Moscow was hardly known as a leader in the fashion world, nor was it known as a significant producer of movies. The attack here is against the West in general, and Hollywood in particular. Ottaviani condemns, quote, "the modern world," unquote, just about in toto, along with its emphasis on technical progress, its modes of life, and its growing means of propaganda and publicity, end quote, in a way that would have prompted Paul Blanchard to say, "I told you so," even at the Ecumenical Council, which had the reputation of opening up the windows of the church to the winds of liberalism. That's Vatican II. Propaganda and publicity, it should be remembered, were the stock in trade of the United States regime and of the CIA, which was ostensibly the Vatican's ally in the war against communism. But by the time of the council in the early 60s, the alliance was over. And it was over primarily because it was becoming increasingly clear that the, quote, propaganda and publicity, unquote, Ottaviani warned against, were being used more effectively against Catholics than against communists. There were signs on both sides, Ostpolitik on the part of the Vatican and the contraceptive campaign on the part of the Rockefellers, that a new era was dawning, an era which reached its culmination in 1974 at the UN-sponsored Bucharest Conference on World Population, where the Vatican forged an alliance with communist bloc countries and the Third World to block Rockefeller's attempt to institute Malthusian birth quotas throughout the world. John D. Rockefeller III's interest in the Catholic Church reawakened in the early 60s for a number of reasons. To begin with, the Catholic Church was the only enemy to the Rockefeller eugenics campaign left standing. With the defection of the mainline Protestants on sexual issues, Catholics were the only obstacle to the policies Rockefeller wanted to implement throughout the world. J.D.R. III was also intrigued by the news he was hearing about the impending Vatican Council. Rockefeller's biographers, Haar, H-A-R-R, and Johnson, mention that, quote, the papacy of John XXIII, who was elevated in 1958, seemed to promise a liberalizing of Roman Catholic doctrine. During the early 60s, it had become virtually a foregone conclusion among liberal Catholics that the Church would change its teaching on birth control. If so, J.D.R. III was willing to do whatever he could to help that process along. But the attraction was mutual. At the same time, the Rockefeller interests were looking for an opening whereby they could undermine the Catholic Church's opposition to eugenic sexuality. Certain American Catholics were looking for more acceptance from the Protestant consensus, and that meant acceptance by the people who ran the foundations. René Wormser complained that Catholics were frozen out of social science research as a result of the conscious policy of the founders. As of 1957, Wormser could claim, quote, there are 30 million Catholics in this country who maintain scores of universities and colleges. Their institutions do not figure among the favored of the foundation complex, nor are academicians connected with them likely to receive research grants from the complex. Perhaps there is a good reason for this discrimination. If so, I cannot guess what it might be. True, Catholic institutions were included among the institutional donees to which the Ford Foundation recently donated a huge aggregate of money, a step which deserved the most enthusiastic approval of the general public. But when it comes to special individual grants, to find a Catholic institution as a donee is a rarity indeed. For some time during the 50s, Father Theodore Hesburgh, CSC, president of the University of Notre Dame, had been as concerned about this lack of support from the foundations as Wormser was. Father Hesburgh was willing to do whatever it took to get that support and, according to one source, went to the foundations, who told him that to qualify for money, he would have to remove certain faculty members. Hesburgh proved amenable to the suggestion and, as a result, not only started to get grant money, but also was appointed a trustee of the Rockefeller Foundation in 1961. So that would be the definition of a sellout. He's selling out his principles for money. He would later become its chairman during the years when the Rockefeller Foundation was heavily involved in abortion advocacy. By the early 60s, it was clear that both Catholics like Hesburgh and the eugenic foundations felt that they had something to gain by collaborating. What Catholics like Hesburgh wanted was obvious. They wanted money. But they also wanted an entree into the interlocking world of foundation respectability of the sort that had transformed Kinsey from an obsessive masturbator and voyeur into a great scientist. Grantsmanship, certain Catholics were learning, was in many respects an all-or-nothing proposition. Because the foundations were, in effect, a conspiracy of interlocking directorates serving a common ethnic interest, Once the university got money from one, it was in the position of getting money from all of them. And as the 60s progressed and the government expanded its role in funding higher education, foundation acceptance meant access to government money as well. True, it wasn't until LBJ the feds were really involved with a lot of this stuff, particularly K-12 funding. But also college funding expanded over the 20th century. Finally, in the early 70s, that arrangement was codified into law when the Supreme Court decided in Lemon v. Kurtzman that it was unconstitutional to give government money to Catholic grade schools, but, as ratified in the Tilton decisions, acceptable to give it to Catholic universities. The main difference between the two schools was secularization. Catholic universities had secularized themselves, largely by alienating themselves from the church, and Father Hesburgh was the architect of that secularization. What the foundations wanted was just as specific. They wanted the Catholic Church to drop its opposition to contraception, and people like John D. Rockefeller III felt that Father Hesburgh could play a crucial role in accomplishing that end. On October 10, 1962, one day before the opening of the Second Vatican Council, Rockefeller's Population Council, quote, following discussions among leading Catholic authorities, representatives of Planned Parenthood, and the officers of the Population Council, granted $5,000 to the University of Notre Dame to host a two-day meeting in December which would bring together representatives of different religious and other points of view to discuss problems of population growth, with particular interest in exploring areas of possible convergence in approaching these problems, 1962. The conference would not actually take place until early 63, but the groundwork for preparing it took place throughout the summer of 1962. The initial impetus for the conference came not from Hesburgh, but from a CBS documentary, Birth Control and the Law, which aired on May 10, 1962. One of the participants was the Reverend John A. O'Brien, CSC, a Notre Dame theologian who had caught the eye of the pro-contraceptive crowd when an article of his entitled, Let's Take Birth Control Out of Politics, had appeared in the November 10, 1961 issue of Look magazine. The CBS documentary was widely denounced in the Catholic press as pro-contraceptive propaganda. Reverend John B. Sheehan, S-H-E-E-H-I-N, criticized moderator Eric Severide's fawning attitude toward Planned Parenthood and called the documentary an extended commercial for that organization. The Reverend John C. Knott, family life director of the National Catholic Welfare Conference in Washington, claimed that CBS gave evidence of having become a public relations medium for a particular philosophy of life with an oversimplified solution to human problems, and went on to wonder why CBS didn't allow Catholics equal time. Evidently, he missed the contribution of Father O'Brien, or perhaps he didn't feel that Father O'Brien's suggestion that a group of Catholic and Protestant experts should get together to try to iron out the problem qualified as the Catholic position. Either way, he was evidently not impressed with Father O'Brien's position. Other people were, however. On July 6, 1962, Cass Canfield, chairman of Planned Parenthood Foundation of America and a board member of the Population Council, wrote to Father O'Brien to tell him how he had followed his writings on birth control for a number of years and had been impressed with what O'Brien had to say in a recent CBS telecast. In the interest of fostering, quote, dialogue in this area among religious groups, Canfield invited O'Brien to take part in a, quote, small discussion, primarily of Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish clergymen, at a New York hotel on the morning of October 25th, to discuss fertility regulation in the context of responsible parenthood and population growth. In closing, Canfield added, a very, quote, few general questions which might be discussed at the meeting, such as, what is the general thinking from various viewpoints on the population problem, and what are the opportunities among religious groups themselves and between religious groups and the Planned Parenthood Foundation for cooperative thought and action on these vital matters? On July 24th, Canfield received a response, not from Father O'Brien, but from George Schuster, assistant to Father Hesburgh at Notre Dame, informing him that O'Brien's attendance at the Planned Parenthood Conference was out of the question. It is impossible, as matters stand now, Schuster wrote, for Catholic priests and laymen who follow directives, and this is the kind you doubtless want, to attend a meeting sponsored by Planned Parenthood. The time is not yet ripe for that. Those invited would have to secure permission from the New York Chancery Office to attend, and there would seem no possibility that the answer would be affirmative. Schuster's objections, upon closer inspection, revolved around more around form than substance. Consequently, instead of the New York meeting, Schuster proposed holding virtually the same meeting at Notre Dame, implying that the name Notre Dame would somehow purge the meeting of disagreeable associations, as well as helping Catholics eager to collaborate on birth control to evade the watchful eye of Cardinal Spellman. Quote, this arrangement would enable prominent Catholics to attend without difficulty, for any problem involving participation in a meeting sponsored by Planned Parenthood would have been removed. The university has arranged and is currently doing so in a series of meetings in various fields at which important problems are being discussed on a basis of parity between Catholics and others. In a letter to JDR III on July 31st, Canfield can hardly contain himself, calling Schuster's response the answer to a maiden's prayer. Canfield was no maiden, and he probably didn't pray much either. But an opening of some significance had finally been found with the Catholics, the last roadblock to universal acceptance of contraception. During the 50s, the Population Council had a contact with a Jesuit from Baltimore by the name of William J. Gibbons, who requested funding for a New York professional sodality from the Population Council, which would attempt to study the problem of overpopulation as essentially a moral problem. The Population Council was underwhelmed by Father Gibbons's proposal. Frederick Osborne, in a memo to Dudley Kirk, opined that, quote, it is hard to see how there could be much serious exchange of ideas on such premises, especially since Father Gibbon was proposing that each meeting start with a pledge, quote, to respect the right of each parent to participate in the creation of life. If this was what the Catholics had in mind, then the Population Council wasn't interested. What Schuster was proposing at Notre Dame was a whole new ballgame, however, and Canfield urged JDR III to fund it, claiming that it should serve a very useful purpose. So they're co-opting the Catholics bit by bit. Frank Notstein, who was in on the discussion, seemed to concur with Canfield and listed a number of potentially positive outcomes as resulting from it. To begin with, the Population Council and the pro-contraception Protestants who were invited could exert pressure, quote, of the supportive sort on the liberal Catholics attending to strengthen in the Church those elements which recognize A, the need for tolerance of non-Catholic views, B, the desirability for restraint on the part of Catholics seeking legal restrictions that prevent non-Catholics from following their own moral views, and C, the need for greater attention to parental responsibility in Catholic teaching. Beyond that, the conference would provide, quote, an opportunity for the Catholics to educate non-Catholics on their position, particularly with a view to letting us see, in sophisticated form, the almost immutable constraints faced by the Church in certain parts of its position and the operations which are amenable to change. Notstein felt that it was unrealistic to feel that a conference of this sort could get the Church to change its teaching on birth control, but it could help, quote, to strengthen that element in the Church with which we have many common aspirations and a minimum of differences. With this in mind, it would be pointless to publish the results of the conference because that would incur the wrath of episcopal authorities and harden the positions into two immutable fronts. The only influence the pro-contraceptive party can have is on those influential Catholics who attend the meeting. Notstein adds, it is also important on these premises that we select for attendance not representative Catholics, but Catholics who represent the position nearest our own, or unrepresentative Catholics. This is the group whose influence we would be endeavoring to enlarge. The Population Council would fund the Notre Dame meeting, in other words, on the condition that only liberal Catholics, i.e. those willing to work for a change in the Church's position on birth control, be invited. Notstein even suggests, quote, leaving out people such as Father Zimmerman, evidently referring to Reverend Anthony Zimmerman, SVD, a noted opponent of population control. In another letter to JDR III on August 2nd, Notstein reiterated his opposition to inviting, quote, representative Catholics, unquote. The only people to be invited were Catholics, quote, who represent the position nearest our own. Quote, "Personally, I would like to reemphasize my opinion that an endeavor be made to have this group include only the liberal-minded Catholics. We will simply get nowhere if right-wing groups are involved. These conversations should be between people on both sides who have minimum differences of opinion." Throughout the negotiations for the conference, there is no indication that either Schuster, who conducted the correspondence, or Hesburgh, whose approval is noted throughout, objected in any way to the population councils dictating to Notre Dame the type of Catholic Notre Dame was allowed to invite to its conference. Evidently, Notstein's specification that only liberal Catholics should be invited was not construed as an offense against Hesburgh's principle of, quote, "true autonomy and academic freedom in the face of authority of whatever kind, lay or clerical, external to the academic community itself," the principle he enunciated in his Land of Lakes statement in 1967 when he alienated the University of Notre Dame from the Catholic Church by placing it under a lay board of trustees. When it came to the demands of the Population Council, Hesburgh's truculence evaporated and was replaced by the most supine amenability. Notstein obviously feels that Father Hesburgh is precisely one of their kind of Catholics and nominates him as chairman of the conference in place of J.D.R. 3, whose connection with contraception and population control might prove too controversial. Quote, "My guess," Notstein wrote, referring to Hesburgh, "is that he would be effective in blocking long-winded arguments in theology, which are useless once the positions are understood. No one is going to make converts at the theological level." J.D.R. 3 was evidently persuaded by Notstein's arguments. In a letter to Cass Canfield on August 6, J.D.R. 3 characterized Schuster's proposal as, quote, "an encouraging next step in an important and sensitive area." He is also persuaded by Notstein's suggestion that the individuals who might attend be selected from those who have very liberal views, otherwise it would be difficult for the meetings to be very constructive. By early August, the Notre Dame conference was pretty much a done deal, at least in the higher echelons of the Population Council. By September 1962, the Population Council was dictating not only who was to be invited, but what books were to be displayed and discussed, e.g., A Citizen's Perspective on Population by J.D. Rockefeller and Does Overpopulation Mean Poverty by Joseph Jones, as well as the questions to be asked, and without too much stretching of the imagination, the answers to those questions as well. Hesburgh's abject acceptance of Rockefeller's terms gives some indication that academic freedom was essentially a pretext which would allow Notre Dame to get foundation money. In one of his memoirs, Hesburgh talked about defending American theologian John Courtney Murray against Cardinal Ottaviani. In many ways, the example was paradigmatic in Hesburgh's mind. Academic freedom meant protecting Catholics against the influence of Rome. It meant as well supine acceptance of whatever schemes the eugenic regime proposed, whether it was the contraceptive or affirmative action, which Hesburgh supported in the Bakke case in the 1970s. In 1962, as the final plans were being made for the Notre Dame conference, Hesburgh offered no objections to stipulations from the Population Council on who might attend their contraception conference. Hesburgh offered no objections to the fact that they dictated what materials were to be displayed, who was to be invited and not invited, or what would be discussed. Conferees, Canfield wrote in his memo, some random suggestions about the Notre Dame conference, should discuss questions of whether the adherents of any faith have a right to try and influence legislation except as individuals expressing their own views. It didn't take a genius to figure out the right answer to a question phrased in that tendentious manner. Catholics of the liberal sort were to proclaim publicly that their opposition to contraception was personal and that they wouldn't dream of imposing their views on others, and most certainly they would not try to influence legislation. The fact of the matter is that, at this point, Rockefeller did not feel he could get the church to change its teaching on contraception. At a later date, he would be of another opinion on the matter. He did feel, though, that the Population Council might persuade liberal Catholics to persuade their less enlightened co-religionists that they, as Catholics, had no business trying to influence legislation concerning contraception in the United States. Planned Parenthood had already targeted the Connecticut contraception statute for overturning as a prelude. Leader Pfeffer Leo Pfeffer would later say, Planned Parenthood had already targeted the Connecticut contraception statute for overturning as a prelude, Leo Pfeffer would later say, for state-subsidized contraception aimed at primarily Negro welfare recipients. The main obstacle in the implementation of this design was the opposition of the Catholic Church. Canfield kept hammering home the point that when it came to contraception, reasonable Catholics, i.e. the kind who wanted money from the Rockefellers, were supposed to keep their opinions to themselves. This was the purpose of the conference, and by accepting the Population Council's money on their terms, Hesburgh showed that he acquiesced in the arrangement. The conferees were to understand that if, quote, a religious group, as such, should try and influence legislation, that would bring up the question of tolerance. The reason, according to Canfield, the Population Council was putting up the money was in the hope that the liberal views of certain Catholics will gain greater currency within the church, and that practical considerations in connection with limiting population, as well as biological research, partly or wholly sponsored by Catholics, will lead them to become less and less restrictive as to methods. Fred Jaffe, Associate Director of Information and Education at Planned Parenthood, took part in the memo dialogue and came to pretty much the same conclusions. The conference should, quote, focus on objectives rather than methods. This would pare the differences down to size and also, although he doesn't state this, make the church seem unreasonable by its insistence that certain methods are illicit, whereas the Population Council could give the impression to being open to them all. Jaffe concluded by submitting his list of acceptable Catholics. These would include the already mentioned Father Gibbons, S.J., Father Joseph Gremillon of the National Catholic Welfare Conference, who would have a long association with Notre Dame, Father Hesburgh, and Father Walter Imbiorski of the Cana Conference in Chicago, who would eventually run off and get married and die without a Catholic funeral. On October 29, Schuster again wrote to Canfield discussing publicity and indicating he was involved in not a little duplicity in this regard. He requested that no advance publicity be given to the conference lest the wrong people get wind of it, including perhaps the local bishop. In the same letter, however, he indicates that in the hope of indirect benefits, he has invited one or two editors of key Catholic periodicals. This echoes pretty much what Schuster said to Canfield in August when he claimed that we are walking upon relatively difficult terrain and a measure of caution in the hope of better things to follow is indicated. Schuster was not so much interested in keeping the symposium secret as he was in managing the way information on it came out. Publicity would only be harmful if the wrong people showed up beforehand. Notstein, in a note written after the conference, hopes that, quote, there were no unfortunate leaks so far as publicity is concerned, and Schuster assures him that there were no leaks, thank heavens. Hope of better things to follow from Schuster and Hesburgh's point of view meant more money from more foundations for more conferences, undermining the church's position on contraception. On June 5, 1963, Schuster submitted a proposal asking for funding for virtually the same conference to the Ford Foundation. The conference was, quote, to achieve a consensus which would first serve as a firm and clear basis for dialogue, and second, point out areas for future study and discussion, which is pretty much what the first one had done. However, this time, Schuster sweetens the pot by adding that the objective is to prepare a final statement and distribute it widely. The statement would, it was understood, be Catholic academe calling for a change in the church's teaching. Something that would most probably not change the teaching, but something which would prove embarrassing to the church nonetheless, especially if it were promoted by the media. I am not going to stress further the obvious importance of this effort, Schuster wrote to Oscar, Bud, Harkavy, head of the Ford Foundation, H-A-R-K-A-V-Y. The interest of Cardinal Meyer, Schuster's emphasis, which is the only part of this letter which is at present confidential, suffices to indicate that these deliberations may find an echo far beyond the confines of the United States. The Rockefeller crowd got the proposal passed on to them directly from Harkavy, something which indicates just how close the interlock between the foundations was, Ford and Rockefeller. Harkavy was, in effect, asking the people at the Population Council whether he should fund Notre Dame's grant or not, and the Population Council seemed less than enthused by the prospect of another conference, much less a whole series of conferences. The Population Council had gone to bed with Notre Dame and in the morning decided that it didn't respect her anymore. Ford would eventually go on to sponsor a whole series of conferences during which the Catholics assembled at Notre Dame denounced in increasingly strident terms the church's position opposing contraception. But the contempt in which the Population Council held Notre Dame is evident in the tone of their memos. Dudley Kirk goes after suggesting that they might, quote, sponsor this and play it further by ear, goes on to wonder whether to feel flattered or otherwise at being the only heretic proposed for inclusion in the first conference. Which prompts Marshall C. Balfour to add, hooray for the heretic, the cards are surely stacked against him. That is, unless the way is being prepared for Pope Paul to change the rules of the game. The wing of the Catholic Church, whose conferences were sponsored by Rockefeller money, were clearly planning for such an eventuality. Since most of the players were old and ostensibly celibate, there is no reason to believe that they were hoping to benefit directly from such a change, but a change in the Church's teaching would mean that they, as Catholic academics, would be acceptable to the Foundation power brokers, and an acceptable member of the American Protestant consensus, the WASP ethnos, as well. They would be considered Americans in full standing, which has always been the aspiration of a certain kind of Catholic in this country. With people like Father Hesburgh calling the shots for Catholics in the U.S., the Pope could unpack his bags for good this time. Changing the Church's teaching on contraception would furthermore show that Hesburgh and company had considerable clout among their co-religionists. If they could show that they had delivered the vote on contraception, they might be valuable for wringing other concessions from the Church further down the line, in case the Protestant consensus did a 180 turn on abortion, for example. Perhaps this is why people like Schuster and Hesburgh pursued the idea of the contraception conference with such avidity throughout the mid-60s. Throughout the entire degrading process of applying for a grant which specified not only who Notre Dame could and could not invite, the books that were to be discussed, as well as the questions and, by implication, answers that were to arise during the course of discussion, there is not one indication that Father Hesburgh thought that the academic freedom of Notre Dame was being compromised. His vigilance for academic freedom virtually ceased to exist when it came to the Rockefellers, who set much more stringent stipulations than any proposed by Cardinal Ottaviani or the Vatican. This policy of no enemies to the left was to have several far-reaching consequences. First of all, academic freedom was defined as de facto the right to proselytize for sexual liberation. This was true not only of Catholic universities, but across the board. Political correctness is, in the final analysis, the use of academe to justify sexual engineering. Secondly, through Hesburgh's efforts, the Church lost control of Notre Dame, and in the place of Catholicism, liberalism was installed as the university's regnant ideology. Thirdly, sexual liberation would come home to roost at Notre Dame, as the theology department was plagued by a series of sexual scandals throughout the period following the 1967 Lando Lake Statement, its declaration of independence from church control. In September 1987, Reverend Niels K. Rasmussen, O.P., head of the liturgy program at Notre Dame, was found shot to death in the basement of his home, surrounded by homosexual pornography, the paraphernalia of sadomasochism, and automatic weapons. When Notre Dame tried to give Rasmussen a Christian burial, against the express wishes of his will-come-suicide note, a bomb threat interrupted the services and emptied Sacred Heart Church on campus. Rasmussen's case is only the most spectacular instance of a series of sexual scandals which take place with such regularity that no one gets very upset about them anymore. As a result, blackmail has become a common, if unacknowledged, form of intimidation, influencing the governance of the university to the detriment of Catholic principle, turning the university into an instrument of the WASP ethnos to the detriment of Catholic interest, both political and cultural. Congressman Carol Reese of Tennessee had become so alarmed at the power of tax-exempt foundations like Ford, Carnegie, and Rockefeller that he convened congressional hearings on the role of these foundations in undermining the democratic institutions of the United States. By the mid-50s, it was clear that the CIA/Foundation/anti-Catholic cabal was heavily involved in black operations, quote-unquote, i.e. operations against citizens of the United States, which clearly constituted illegal activity. The threat of communism had allowed this door to be opened, and now anyone who opposed the goals of the above group or threatened to expose their methods were fair game to be targeted. Congressman Reese had to learn this the hard way. But he was only an individual. In terms of groups that were going to be targeted, the next victim after black operations were tolerated against domestic communism was obvious. It was the Catholics, and the psychological warfare waged against the church in the U.S. would be the battle over contraception, which reached its culmination in mid-1965 when the Supreme Court handed down its Griswold v. Connecticut decision and Senator Ernst Gruning of Alaska started holding hearings about overpopulation and how the government meant to solve this problem. Congressman Reese, Simpson writes, quote, took as his theme that major U.S. foundations, including the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Carnegie Corporation, and the Social Science Research Council, were engaged in a campaign to promote socialism and one-world government through funding social science studies Reese regarded as critical of the U.S. and the free enterprise economic system. He singled out John Dewey, Samuel Stouffer, and Bernard Berelson, among others, as the purported ringleaders. Bernard Berelson was trained as a librarian, but by the late 40s was considered an expert in public relations and the manipulation of public opinion. 1 year after the publication of Blanchard's book on Catholic power, Berelson co-edited Public Opinion and Communication with Morris Janowitz, one of the seminal works on communications theory, and a good indication of how psychological warfare techniques refined during World War II were now going to be turned on the American public as a way of controlling them through the manipulation of the new media, i.e. radio and television. Berelson establishes the book's major premise in his introduction. Quote, growing secularization has meant that more and more areas of life are open to opinion rather than divine law, and to communication rather than revelation. Growing industrialization has not only extended literacy, in addition, it has provided the technical facilities for mass communication. The goal of secularization was the reduction of all of life's imperatives to opinions, which is to say, not the expression of moral absolutes or divine law. Once this secularization occurred, the people who controlled the opinions controlled the country. Berelson is equally frank about where the new science of public opinion originated. Quote, research in the field was accelerated during World War II by demands for studies on the effect of communications upon military personnel, adjustment to army life and attitudes toward military leaders, enemy propaganda, and civilian morale. After the war, this growing interest led to the establishment of additional university centers for the study of public opinion and communication by the methods of social science. Together with the continuing activities of industry and government, they now represent a large-scale research enterprise. So they develop these techniques, study soldiers and their attitudes and combatants in the war, and then they turn it on the general population using the new radio and TV. Just how large-scale would become clear before long. But before that happened, some significant changes had to be made to the realm of what was communicable. In 1959, Berelson wrote that the great ideas that gave the field of communications research so much vitality 10 and 20 years ago have to a substantial extent worn out. No new ideas of comparable magnitude have appeared to take their place. We are on a plateau. The way off of this plateau was clear enough if one read Berelson's 1950 book carefully, particularly his claim that there is a virtual pro-religious monopoly on communications available to large audiences in America today, from 1950. Religious belief meant, ipso facto, the opposite of opinion, and therefore ideas not subject to the manipulation of the people who control the communications media. What needed to be done, then, was move large areas of thought from the realm of religion to the realm of opinion if any significant breakthrough in political control through manipulation of the media were to take place. Sexual morality was the most important area of religious thinking that needed to be moved into the realm of, quote, opinion, unquote, where it would then be under the control of psychological warriors like Berylson and those who paid his salary, namely the Rockefellers. Says Jones, and this is precisely what happened. So sexual morality moves from under the church to under the mass media, controlled by psychological warfare experts. During the 1960s, at the same time Hollywood was trying to break the production code and introduce nudity to the big screen, Berylson was hard at work for John D. Rockefeller III, running opinion polls whose purpose was to change the attitude of the American public toward contraception. A particular interest in this regard were the attitudes of Catholics, whose opinions Berylson manipulated through a series of leading questions that were put to Catholics in the wake of Pope Paul VI's appearance at the UN in 1964. Question number 8 of the survey Berylson was working on at the time asked, "The Roman Catholic Church does not approve many methods of birth control. Do you believe that the Church should change its position on this matter?" It didn't take a brain surgeon to figure out the right answer to this and other tendentious questions, whose purpose was to insinuate the idea that the Church should change her teaching into the mind of the population at large. The Population Council was working behind the scenes in other areas as well. Through the Notre Dame Conference, Notre Dame sociologist Donald Barrett made contact with the Population Council, to whom he applied for a grant. The Population Council, in another instance of the same interlock we have already seen, then forwarded the application to the Ford Foundation, which granted Barrett $500,000 in the mid-60s. The story becomes more complicated when Barrett, with Hesburgh's help, got appointed to Pope Paul VI's Birth Control Commission. Now someone who was receiving money from the foundation establishment at the very time it was trying to change American laws and Catholic teaching on contraception was voting on the commission Paul VI had established to decide whether the church should change its position on the same topic. It was a flagrant conflict of interest, but no one seems to have noticed at the time. The same can be said of Pat and Patty Crowley, head of the Catholic Family Movement at the time. The Crowleys had been appointed to birth control commission because of their connection to Notre Dame, while at the same time getting money from the Rockefellers to undermine the church's teaching on contraception. According to Robert McClory, their biographer, just as the church was about to issue Humanae Vitae, the Crowleys, with a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation, Jones's emphasis, made plans for an international forum on the Christian family and the world to be held in Italy during the summer of 1968. And that will conclude the chapter in today's session. This was all about how Notre Dame sold out, and basically the leaders of their church cared less about Catholic principles than about getting money. And to get money dispersed by the large foundations and through them the government, run by similar people, people of similar mind, they had to change their position on population, overpopulation, and birth control, and they proved willing to do that, notably Hesburgh. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.